Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin on the eve of the Sochi Winter Olympics and get an analysis of how this big showcase event will play for Vladimir Putin at home and abroad, as the foreign press focuses on shoddy amenities at hotels and stray dogs, while the Russian press gushes with pride. Clifford Gaddy, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-author of Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin, joins us to discuss the economics behind this $51 billion bash that is meant to highlight Russia's sense of its own cultural, political, and moral standards, which, unlike the West and America in particular, respects sovereignty of others and does not seek to impose its values. Then we'll look into the peace talks underway between the Pakistani government and a Pakistan Taliban-nominated delegation in Islamabad. The director of the South Asian Center at the Atlantic Council, Suja Nawaz, the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within, joins us to discuss attempts underway to end a decade-long insurgency through talks initiated by Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. We will explore the conditions laid down by the government and look into resistance from the powerful army whose soldiers have died in Taliban attacks across the country. Then finally, we'll get a profile of New Jersey's controversial and embattled governor, Chris Christie, from an award-winning veteran New Jersey journalist, Robert Ingle, the author of The Soprano State, New Jersey's Culture of Corruption, and Chris Christie, the inside story of his rise to power. We will discuss the scandals dogging the likely Republican presidential candidate, who is taking a hit in recent polls from the negative publicity of bridge closings and alleged strong-arm tactics and political retribution over development projects and endorsements. And joining us now is Clifford Gaddy, who is a senior fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution, specializing in foreign policy and global economy and development. He's the co-author with Fiona Hill of Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin, and co-author of Bear Traps on Russia's Road to Modernization. And his forthcoming book is Russia's Addiction, The Political Economy of Resource Dependence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Clifford Gaddy.
My pleasure.
And I imagine that Vladimir Putin, who's putting on this big party prep for himself and Russia, I suppose, he's already getting some pretty negative press. There seems to be a kind of petulance on the part of the Western press there, reporting on the brackish brown water in hotel bathrooms, tweeting about various other nightmares. What's your sense of whether or not this will end up having two narratives, the domestic one that's celebrating a great success and an international one that's sort of churlish and critical?
I think you're right. I think on the first point, the domestic narrative, in my mind, there's no question that this will be portrayed, and probably legitimately so, as a great event for Russia. Of course, it'll be all the better if Russia wins a lot of gold medals, and there's a lot of pressure on their athletes to do it, more even than in perhaps other countries that host the Olympics. There always is that element. But for Russia, this is really quite important. And believe me, Russians, almost all Russians, really, is only, with the exception of a very narrow segment of the population, are quite proud of this. And I think, as far as Russia is concerned, it will be a success for Putin. They won't see it so much as a success for him as a success for the country. And how it's portrayed internationally, well, I guess that's anyone's guess. Maybe when the actual sporting events begin, there will be more focus on the Olympics as the Olympics, less room for the political commentary that we've seen so much of leading up to the Olympics. As you say, a great deal of negative commentary and negative portrayals of Russia, of Putin, of Sochi.
And stray dogs seem to have been getting a lot of press lately for reasons I'm not entirely sure. Have you been to Sochi at all?
I have a couple times, actually, only to have meetings with Putin, so I never really had a chance to look around the city and be a tourist there.
Well, tell us about your meetings with Putin. That doesn't happen often and to a lot of Westerners, so do you mind?
No, it was interesting. I'm in a group that for a number of years now, the Kremlin wants to somehow engage with Western specialists on Russia, and so they invite a group of us from around the world to come there, meet with people, including having a dinner with Putin. I remember the first time we came to Sochi, because they've only rarely been in Sochi, where he has the presidential residence. It was quite dramatic after the dinner. Contrary to the previous practice, Putin stood up and said, well, why don't you join me for cocktails on the terrace at the presidential residence, not the building we were in, the presidential residence, and we can overlook the have a nice view of the Black Sea. So we all went over there. This happened to be the late summer in that summer when Putin first appeared in photographs, bare-chested, riding on horses, diving in icy Siberian rivers and so forth. And believe me, when you got close to him, you could see this was not Photoshopped material. This guy was quite bulked up. He could barely, and I don't even think could, button the top button of his collar. He was so pumped up. It's been interesting just to observe him at close hand, and my colleague Fiona Hill and I tried to portray some of that in this book we wrote about Mr. Putin, the operative in the Kremlin.
Well, Clifford Gaddy, of course, the operative in the Kremlin in many ways asks these questions about whether or not his prior experience in the KGB, where he was not, it was relatively speaking a fairly minor official, whether that has become his MO in terms of running this vast country. And a lot of critics basically say that he is maybe he's not particularly capable of advancing Russia because so much of his focus seems to be on diminishing the United States. Do you think he has that mindset?
The first part, that his methods and way of operating inside of Russia and abroad, by the way, I think definitely derived from the skills that he developed as a KGB case officer, as he puts it, dealing with people, working with people on a one-on-one basis mostly. As for the point that somehow his goal is to act against the United States, or indeed his focus is on the United States, I think that's not really true. His focus is on Russia. He really doesn't care about anybody else, except to the extent that he portrays them as being adversarial towards Russia, trying to undermine Russia's, as he thinks of it, fated historical destiny to become a great power. And he's put it in this, it's a defensive mindset. He's put it in this way, that imagine what Russia would be today if we had not had wars and revolutions. And he, in fact, implies that outside forces have forced Russia into wars and revolutions in order to prevent it from realizing its destiny. I think he firmly believes that, certainly believes that forces outside of Russia are trying to undermine the country and its stability right now. And with that sort of almost paranoid, but certainly quite suspicious and defensive mindset, he, of course, pays a lot of attention to what the United States is doing, especially what he perceives it might be doing in areas relevant to Russia, both geographically and in terms of policy and economics.
Again, I'm speaking with Clifford Gaddy, who's a senior fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution, specializing in foreign policy and global economy and development. He is the co-author with Fiona Hill of Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin, and the co-author of Bear Traps on Russia's Road to Modernization. And his forthcoming book is Russia's Addiction, The Political Economy of Resource Dependence. Well, it does seem, though, that his latest moves, which have gotten a lot of attention and a lot of pushback, is this regressive anti-gay law, which has a kind of a very disgraceful kind of a vigilante component to it. That's gotten a lot of press. And I'm wondering, and xenophobia, racism, and homophobia seem to be playing well in amongst the Narod, and he does seem to be working that. And it seems to be also at play as a subtext in what's going on in the Ukraine. Do you think Putin could be successful in portraying Russian traditional values as being virtuous as opposed to European values being about gay marriage and other stuff that Russians find socially unacceptable?
The answer to that is yes. He is successful in that regard because that he is appealing to the majority of Russians. You can think of them as the silent majority. It's the heartland, it's the mainstream of Russia. There's just no denying that. the portion of the Russian population that is rather enthusiastically Western-oriented, that is willing and wants to have Russia adhere to the same values as Western Europe or at least part of the United States, that's a small sliver of the Russian population. They're concentrated in Moscow. They are certainly much more in contact with the Western media. They're more vocal. And as we saw in late 2011 and the early 2012, they're willing, some of them at least, to get out onto the streets and demonstrate. But the fact remains that the overwhelming majority, I would argue, of Russians would support Putin and his description of Russian traditional values, not the opposition's. So he's doing this out of pragmatic reasons. I personally do not, and I believe me, I've studied Putin for a long time. I personally don't believe that he's homophobic or particularly homophobic. I absolutely do not believe that he's a racist or certainly not an anti-Semite. But it's absolutely true that he, as the KGB operative that he was and essentially still is, uses such social forces for political ends and attempts to manipulate them as a social engineer would do. Those tendencies, the racism, the xenophobia, the anti-Semitism, the homophobia, those are deep in the Russian population, probably not so shallow in other countries as well. And it's a very dangerous situation because what Putin is trying to do is, as I said, manipulate them, use them for his political ends, but certainly not to unleash them. And in fact, I think he recognizes that one of the biggest dangers to the cohesion and the unity of the Russian people, which is his fundamental platform, the unity of all Russians are one, it would be to unleash ethnic tension, separatism, ethnic violence, racial violence, or religious divisions. And so he treads this narrow path, this very delicate balance between manipulating these feelings and these sentiments that are actually there. He's not creating them. They're there. And at the same time, trying to prevent them from getting out of control.
Well, but Clifford Gaddy, in many ways, it would seem that if you're not a racist and you're not a homophobe and you're not an anti-Semite, but you use all of those poisonous tools for political purposes because you're cynical, that strikes me as being even worse.
That may be true. Yeah, in some ways it is.
So
it would be easy for Putin to try to lead a campaign against homophobia, against racism, against anti-Semitism, do it in a very strong and serious and concerted way. He never does that. There are politicians, there are top officials in the Russian Orthodox Church who utter absolutely despicable statements in all of these regards, and Putin doesn't censure them. He doesn't vehemently protest against what they've said. He'll say, I would never believe that, but he doesn't conduct a campaign that would try to remedy that. And he's doing this for political reasons, because he's in the case of especially the homophobic policies, they are a pandering, if you like, to the Russian Orthodox Church, which is extremely conservative in this regard.
Well, one of the United Russia figures recently made an extraordinary statement in regard to Western criticism of the anti-gay laws, etc., saying that the West should be tolerant of, and who claim to be tolerant, should be tolerate. They should tolerate our values.
Yeah.
So that was quite a piece of mental gymnasium going on there. But
well, it may be, but you hear exactly the same thing, not only in the United States, but in every country in Western Europe. These aren't universally accepted values even in the West, and they are, to the extent that they've been accepted and could be considered a majority view and have been set in legislation to restrict especially anti-gay activity or propaganda or anything, this is highly controversial. So you have to, and of very recent date. So Russia, I'm not excusing this. I'm just simply saying that it is not strange that you have a strong majority in Russia that really feels that Putin is accurately representing, faithfully representing their point of view. The criticism with him is that he's not leading the country in a different direction and trying to modernize it in that regard and bring it into accord with the trends in the rest of the world.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Clifford Gaddy, Senior Fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution, and co-author with Fiona Hill of Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. In terms of the other criticism that we hear about Putin, and that is, there was a very scathing book done by Masha Gessen about him that suggests, in effect, that he's the sort of capo di capo, that he regulates the oligarchs. And apparently there is a difference there because to what's happening in the Ukraine, where the kleptocratic family, Yanukovych family, the eldest son, the dentist, apparently basically shakes down the oligarchs and says, you know, I'm now your new 50% partner. But contrasting that, Putin allegedly sort of regulates the oligarchs and is kind of like a mafia boss. Is that a fair criticism?
Well, that's pretty much what my co-author Fiona Hill and I describe in our book about Putin. That is exactly his system. His system is based on very personal relationships, ultimately based on mutual corruption. In effect, the closest people around Putin are partners in his crimes. And his control over the oligarchs, these are private, these are some of the richest private business people in the world. He tolerates them. He works with them because he has control over them through various forms of blackmail. And he, when he came into office in the year 2000, he literally sat down with them and they came to a mutual agreement, a pact, a deal, an agreement that in part is a pure protection racket because Putin offered that he would protect them against the overwhelming popular sentiment that would like to just dispossess them completely of all their ill-gained riches, their stolen property from the Russian people, etc., as it's put, and probably do more than that, probably hang them from the nearest lamppost. Putin was their protector. He said, I'm not going to nationalize your property. I'm going to protect you from that. But more importantly, I'm going to protect you from each other. It happened that the oligarchs, at exactly that point, were in a fierce internal battle with each other. And we can note that there hasn't been no internal squabbles or serious strife between the oligarchs since. They're all in agreement. Khodorkovsky was part of that deal. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the head of Yukos, was part of that deal. He's the only one of the oligarchs who sort of violated the terms of the deal, if you like, in many different ways. And he was punished for it. And none of the other oligarchs stood up for Khodorkovsky. They basically kept quiet, but in fact were saying that he broke the rules, so he has to pay. But that the control he has over the oligarchs is key to his whole system, because the counter service that they deliver to him in return for his protection, if you like, is that they have to not only pay formal taxes in fairly massive amounts, which they weren't doing before Putin came, but they also pay informal taxes. They have to place orders of their gigantic companies, place orders with subcontractors or input suppliers. They don't go looking around for the lowest cost supplier. You're not allowed to do that. You must look first and foremost to some of these big dinosaur factories that Russia inherited from the Soviet Union and which employ literally millions of workers who are Putin's core constituency. This is the heartland. This is the silent majority I referred to. These are the workers at these kinds of factories scattered across Russia. And so their jobs have to be protected, incomes have to be protected, and the oligarchs play a key role in doing that.
So, Clifford Gaddy, then, just in closing, do you think that this unprecedented $51 billion that allegedly been spent on the Sochi Olympics, will Putin get his value? I mean, he's got some problems. I mean, he seems to have handled foreign policy very skillfully in terms of his interest in Syria. I think many people think he totally bested the United States on that. But he does have a problem in the Ukraine. Even within the pro-Russian part of the Ukraine, they look like they're fed up with Yanukovych's kleptocracy. And so just in closing, do you think, short of a terrorist incident, is it going to work out for him, Sochi?
In his eyes, yes. In his eyes, yes. It served the purpose of helping to funnel some of these oil and gas rents, the oil and gas wealth, into a broader part of the population. That's described often as massive corruption. Now, that money is not going into somebody's pockets, part of it is. It's going into excess cost of building all these construction projects and so forth. It's therefore trickling down to these ineffective, inefficient, and unprofitable companies that are referred to. So this is part of the whole game. These are the so-called mega projects that Putin has used to drive the economy and provide job stability, income stability for the big part of the population that are not working at factories that are otherwise competitive and really sustainably viable in the international competition. The question, of course, is just how long can you continue to do that, especially as the Russian economy is not growing at the rate it was growing before, because oil prices are not soaring as high as they did before. So this will be considered, I'm sure, by Putin a success. What happens in the future is a different question.
Well, you know, just in closing, it seems like you're portraying a picture of the worst of capitalism and the worst of communism combined in terms of an economy.
Yeah.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Clifford Getty.
It's my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Clifford Getty, who's a senior fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution, specializing in foreign policy and global economy and development. He's a co-author with Fiona Hill of Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin, and co-author of Bear Traps on Russia's Road to Modernization. And his forthcoming book is Russia's Addiction, The Political Economy of Resource Dependence. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into peace talks underway between the Pakistani government and Pakistan's Taliban. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Suja Nawaz, who is the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. Suja Nawaz is a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. He's also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. He is currently the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Suja Nawaz.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you again.
Good to talk to you again, Suja. And the peace talks underway now between the Pakistan government and Pakistani Taliban, a nominated team being held in Islamabad, are themselves something of a surprise. They've been initiated by Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, but I take it the army has not been particularly thrilled with this development.
Well, it's not clear if they've been thrilled or not, but certainly the army has been talking with Prime Minister Sharif and looking at their various options. It seems obvious to me that the government is trying to begin the talks with a view to seeing if they can yield any results. Frankly, I doubt that they will. They may end up using the failure of the talks to actually launch a military operation, which has been long planned and long awaited in North Waziristan. We don't know if the new military chief, General Raheel Sharif, is going to follow through on that. But his recent response to an attack on the military by the militants was quite rapid, and so it may be an opportunity for him to make a change from the previous policy of his predecessor.
Well, apparently, there've been more than 100 people killed, including a lot of soldiers, from Taliban attacks across the country just in January alone, and thousands have been killed since the Pakistani Taliban came into focus, I guess, in about 2007. So what's your sense, since you've studied the Pakistan army, what is there? Is this an affront to them? I mean, one of the old sort of jokes about Pakistan, if you will, is that it's not a country with an army so much as an army with a country. So is this a thorn in their side, the notion that you have this kind of challenge from within the country itself?
Yes, I think it is, and you are quite right. The military has suffered direct casualties. In my own recent look at just North Waziristan alone, in the last 2 years, they've had 270 casualties, of which something like 90-odd were killed. So there are losses that have been directly suffered by them, largely because of their generally passive posture, which one general described to me as a sitzkrieg. They've been basically in camps, not out on active patrolling, and the Taliban have hit them and have killed their people. So there is some anger and disquiet among the lower-level commanders, and I'm sure the new army chief will be responding to their concerns. But I think at a bigger political level, with a change of government, a new prime minister who has a pretty strong position in parliament, he has an opportunity to shape public opinion at home. And one way that he may be thinking he can do it is by opening the possibility of talks with the Tehrik-e-Taliban of Pakistan, the TTP. And if the talks fail, then to follow through with a military option. However, two things are missing. One, there hasn't been an active public engagement on this issue and no public debate. And number two, it's not clear whether there is a combined civil-military plan for a post-military operation in Fatah particularly. Without that, this will be just another clearing operation, and the militants will disappear into other agencies, into other parts of the country, and then regroup whenever they feel like it. The only targets that are likely to remain are going to be the Arabs or the Chechens or the Uzbeks or the Uyghurs, who don't have any place to go to.
So, Sujan Nawaz, what do they represent, the TTP? I mean, what is their agenda? What are they asking the country for? And because my understanding is they may have some traction within the areas bordering on Afghanistan, but in the rest of the country, I don't think there's a lot of respect for them, to say the least.
Well, in the very, very first round of talks that took place today, it was proposed by the government that the talks should be confined to the troubled areas of North and South Waziristan. So this is really not about even all of Fatah or all of Pakistan. But you're right, the TTP, the Pakistani Taliban, have basically a very simple aim. They want to establish an Islamic Emirate in that territory first, and then in the province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, which is formerly the Northwest Frontier Province, and then in the whole country. They don't have the political base for doing that, so they're going to use whatever leverage they can to get local control and advantage. The government cannot afford to give them this objective, and so the talks are not likely to be very fruitful, in my view.
So this sounds a little bit like megalomania on their part. Is it simply that they are, by definition, religious fundamentalists who are absolutists, that there's no nuance, there's no compromise? I mean, it sounds a little bit vainglorious, doesn't it, that you can eventually end up with your kind of Islamic State in this country?
Well, their support base is largely uneducated, very backward, in a very backward area of the country. So it's not surprising that they've taken this very simple approach that people can understand. This is not an approach that will go down very favorably in the urban environment in Pakistan or among the educated people of Pakistan. And they certainly know that. So they're trying for maximum local advantage. There is another issue which is worth looking at, and that is that the traditional TTP leadership came from South Waziristan, from the Masood tribe. So the first leader was Baitullah Masood. He was succeeded by Hakimullah Masood. Both of them fell to drone attacks. And then after an interregnum with a temporary leader, Mullah Fazlullah, who was from Swat, a region which is quite distant from Fatah, became the leader of the TTP. Now, he is not even known to be in Pakistan. Last sightings report him to be across the border in the Kunar province of Afghanistan. So there is probably a rift developing between the traditional leadership of the Masood, who were ejected from South Waziristan after the military operation, and the new leadership of the TTP. So it could well be that the Masood are willing to make some kind of a deal that allows them to go back to their home in South Waziristan. And then we'll see what Mullah Fazlullah says. For a man who worked under the name of Mullah Radio, because he was very adept at using radio propaganda in Swat and Malakand, he has been awfully quiet for the last few weeks. So we don't even know where he stands on the talks.
But hasn't there been, in the areas where the Pakistani Taliban, the TTP, have been active, they have turned a lot of their violence towards, particularly in the Swat, towards the Sufi and towards Sufi shrines. There's also been some hideous attacks on the Shiite minority. I recall the cricket star Imran Khan, who's also was running in the recent elections and has some kind of a constituency there. He was the most sympathetic to the militants, and he was very, very, there was tremendous backlash against him. So give me a sense of you know, what their priorities are, if indeed they appear to be going after fellow Islamists first.
They do, because they have a very rigid view, and they're also not very good at preparing the ground with their so-called allies, which was evident in the lead-up to these talks with the government. They named a group to represent them, and two members of that group, one Imran Khan, the former cricket player turned politician, and the other Maulana Fazlur Rahman of the Jamiat-e-Ulama-Islam party, both said that they weren't consulted about it, and they basically said they wouldn't participate. So clearly, they don't have that level of sophistication in political discourse. And neither do they have the support of people in the cities, which is what they will need if they are going to get any political traction.
Well, one of the things I find puzzling about the idea that you have a Pakistan Taliban and then you have the Afghanistan Taliban is that the Pakistan government, and particularly the army, we understand, and the Army Intelligence Service, the ISI, have sort of been supporting the Afghan Taliban as a hedge or as a means to have leverage in whatever government ends up in Afghanistan. But one of the analysts I spoke with the other day, former head of the State Department's Intelligence Bureau on Pakistan, was saying that the Pakistani government is now coming to realize that a radical regime in Afghanistan, a radical Taliban regime in Afghanistan, would in fact blow back on Pakistan and destabilize Pakistan. So what is the relationship between these two Talibans? And it seems like, on the one hand, the Pakistan government's negotiating with its own Taliban, but leery of this kind of monster that is created, if you will, in Afghanistan.
Well, I think the analyst from the Department of State was quite right. The Pakistanis have realized that there is a very real danger if the Taliban were to come to power in Afghanistan, and particularly if they take Kabul and the central government, because either that or if they control the border region with Pakistan, there will be the possibility of what I call reverse sanctuary. So the Pakistani Taliban and other militant groups, including the Punjabi Taliban, could then use Afghanistan as a sanctuary to continue their battle against the state. And there have been links between the two Taliban. They haven't been particularly strong, but the TTP has sworn allegiance to the Mullah Omar, the leader of the Afghan Taliban. And so I think that's what worries the Pakistanis. There's also the reality that neither the Pakistanis nor the Afghans alone can seal the border. So they're going to have to work very closely together once the coalition forces depart to try and make sure that they can disrupt any movement which is antithetical to the aims of both states. I think for once Afghanistan and Pakistan are on the same page. The old linkages between the Pakistani intelligence and the Taliban are perhaps not as strong as they once were. And in any case, even if the links are there, I think the control is much less evident. The Afghan Taliban are a fairly independent bunch, which is why you're hearing stories of some Afghan Taliban members being held in Pakistani custody and not being fully released to go and participate in reconciliation talks in Afghanistan.
Well, Sujan Nawaz, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Not at all. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Sujan Nawaz, who's the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. Sujan Nawaz is a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political strategic analyst. He's also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. He is currently the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll come back with a profile on New Jersey's controversial and embattled governor. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Engel, who is the Trenton Bureau Chief for Gannett New Jersey Newspapers, who writes a syndicated column called Politics Patrol, an award-winning veteran journalist, broadcaster, and New York Times bestselling author. His books include The Soprano State, New Jersey's Culture of Corruption, and Chris Christie, the inside story of his rise to power. He tweets at BobEngel99. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Engel.
Glad to be here, sir.
And your fascination with the New Jersey governor, having done a biography on him, and he's certainly very much in the news now, some of the luster's coming off. Is that is this something that you had any inkling of, that this is was a rising star that who would rise forever?
Well, people ask me about, in terms of the 2016 presidential race that he had he's widely rumored to be interested in, if there was anything in his background that would cause a problem. In other words, they were asking how well we vetted him for the book. And I said, we vetted him pretty well. I didn't see anything there. We have the good, the bad, and the ugly in the book. And if you want to know anything about Chris Christie, that's where you go. In fact, a lot of the newspapers around the country now are reading our book and writing stories about it based on the book. But I said, if he gets in trouble over anything, it's probably going to be something that is relatively minor happening in New Jersey that's just going to grow and grow. And that apparently is exactly what has happened. Not that if you have to cross the George Washington Bridge, that's minor. It's the busiest bridge in the world. But it is nothing really, really big and egregious in his background. that led to this. This is something that was going on by his current associates, apparently. We don't know everything yet, of course.
Well, now, in terms of the vetting that was done by Mitt Romney, who apparently considered him, Christie, as a potential vice presidential candidate, was there any indication that he was rejected based upon some information that Mitt Romney had dug up?
I don't see anything. There is a situation involving New Jersey law that has to do with fundraising from Wall Street. And it's complicated, and I won't get into that. But that might have been a problem if he had been on the team raising money. The other thing that I'm hearing is that the people around Romney really didn't like dealing with Christie, the New Jersey governor, who tends to be brash and tell it like it is. I think some of them got their nose bent out of joint because of his directness.
So just a chemistry issue then, you think?
I think it mostly was the stories that I've heard. For instance, when he was at the Republican convention in Tampa, they had done a video of him that it actually looks pretty good. And before he gave the keynote, they were going to be running that that video. Well, somebody ran over. And they got off their time schedule, and so they told him that he'll go out and he'll give the speech, but they won't run the video. And he basically told them, if the video doesn't run, I'm not giving a speech. So what were they going to do, right? They ran the video. And I think if it's things like that, they, you know, many times the people around politicians and powerful and famous people tend to take on the authority of whoever they work for, and sometimes they get bent out of shape if they think that they're not being given the respect they think they deserve.
Well, it does seem, Bob Ingle, though, that Christie's paying a price, at least in the polls. The latest poll from Quinnipiac that came out on Thursday, which is a poll from Colorado, a swing state, for, talking about 2016, which of course seems to be a rather premature exercise, shall we say.
Yes.
But they're saying, the poll says that the percentage of Coloradans who say Christie would make a good president dropped from 48% in November to 36% today. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't look good.
Well, no, but you know how public opinion polls are. If they're done correctly, Quinnipiac is one of the better polls. If they're done correctly, they're good for the day that they're done. You can't project them down the road. And in politics, 2 years is like 50 in real people years. Anything can change. And the American electorate tends to have a very short memory. Larry Sabato at the University of Virginia, very, very respected man in political circles, came out with the crystal ball standing of the people who have the best chance of being the Republican nominee for president currently. And Christie is not in the top spot anymore. He's in the third spot. But Sabato says he's still in the top tier. This thing could still come out. There's a long time to go on it. I have a lot of respect for his judgment. I think that's probably absolutely correct. It remains to be seen how this is going to turn out. All we've got so far is some allegations. I think this is probably going to be with us for about a year before it all gets sorted out. And then the public will make up its mind about what did Christie know, when did he know it, and did he do something that he shouldn't have done, or did the people around him do something and he had the wool pulled over his eyes? And then you have to deal with, well, what kind of people does he have around him, and how could he be fooled? So we'll be dealing with this for a while.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Ingle, who is the Trenton Bureau Chief for Gannett New Jersey Newspapers, who writes a syndicated column called Politics Patrol, an award-winning veteran journalist, broadcaster, and New York Times bestselling author. His books include The Soprano State, New Jersey's Culture of Corruption, and Chris Christie, The Inside Story of His Rise to Power. He tweets at BobIngle99. But one of the things that I find difficult to understand, and I suspect a lot of the public are somewhat troubled by this, is that You know that this whole bridge scandal that got him into trouble in the first place was supposedly a traffic study. The idea that you would screw up the traffic on a monumental scale to the most important artery between these two big states on the surface makes absolutely no sense. But if it's all about when did he know and when did he know it, he, of course, went out of his way to say he didn't know it beforehand for obvious reasons. He fired everybody. And then in that long mea culpa that he did in front of the New Jersey Assembly, he also went out of his way to say that when it was happening, he didn't know anything about it. Because presumably, as the governor, if you'd find out that there's a disaster going on and you did nothing about it, you'd also be culpable. So, I mean, how could you not know about it?
Well, he, in fact, addressed that this week because that's what all of us are asking. The bridge is the busiest in the world. A lot of people cross that every day. How could you not know that? And what he said was, you hear traffic reports about the bridge being backed up every day. He didn't think it was anything out of the ordinary. And he also said something this week that we had never heard before. He said that he asked his chief of staff to check with the Port Authority and find out if there was anything unusual going on. Now, if he had said that to me, I would have said, what did the report back tell you? But that question wasn't asked. So conceivably, he could have asked his chief of staff to check with the Port Authority, then talk to Wildstein at the Port Authority, who might have told him, we're doing a traffic study and it's not going very well. And he came back and told the governor, well, they were doing a traffic study. It wasn't going very well. You know, I mean, conceivably that could have happened. I don't know if it did or not. But if that were the case, then he could be telling the truth that when he checked into it, they told him a traffic study and he just accepted it. You know, you go a little further and you say, why would anybody do a traffic survey like that? Why wouldn't you do it on computers? Because they design airplanes on computers. Why can't they do traffic studies? But perhaps, you know, he tied up with other things and just didn't go any further. So conceivably, it could have come down that way. And the way he has handled this earlier this week when he was doing a radio interview, which is the first thing he's done since that two-hour marathon press conference that he gave, he sounded to me like a defense attorney addressing the jury in a summation. He said, the only thing that matters is I didn't know. Well, you know, what he's trying to do is he's trying to build a case for if they can't, you know, if the glove doesn't fit, you know, you can't convict kind of a thing. If I didn't know about it, then nothing happened. That isn't true. There's lots of issues that are affected in this. But he seems, that would tell me, based on the whole record of this thing, that he's pretty sure there is nothing that links him to having any knowledge of this before it happened.
But the New Jersey radio appearance that you refer to on New Jersey's 105.5 FM show on Monday, you're alluding to a pretty softball interview, right?
Of course. It was a very softball interview. That's not a public service show or anything. It's a paid program. There's nothing that says the governor has to do it. He could walk away and say, no, I'm not going to do that show anymore. That's what John Corzine, his predecessor, did. Now, if he walks away and doesn't do this show anymore, it's a paid show, so they lose the advertising. And some would argue that that's incentive for throwing softball questions. The only new news that came out of it, other than he asked his chief of staff to look into it, was the fact that his office had been subpoenaed by the U.S. Attorney's Office. That was the only new news in a whole hour.
So is there, you think, in terms of, you're saying he may just sort of be able to, this will go on for a while, but he may be able to ride out the storm. What about, though, we're talking about, that's the political front. What about the legal front?
Well, we have to wait and see what the, I'm not a lawyer, don't even play one on radio, but I don't know. There's some people who have said that, you know, maybe this gets to a RICO situation. It really depends on why it was closed. None of us, I repeat, none of us think it had anything to do with a traffic study. We just don't believe that. The other thing is that, in fact, the Port Authority's already said there was no real traffic study going on. Now, a lot of people believe that it had something to do with the Democratic mayor not endorsing him for re-election, and it was sort of a payback kind of thing. That's really trivial and trite, and there's a lot of downside for that. There's another theory that because there is a new development going on there in Fort Lee at the foot of the bridge, a multi-billion dollar development that's very important to the town and the mayor, and that these traffic lanes were very, very important to that development, because without them, the development would be next to worthless, because you've got to be able to get in and out of there and get across the bridge. So there are some people who think there may be a connection there somehow to this development. It remains to be, you know, whatever it is they find out is what's going to determine which way it goes legally. And at this point, the only people who really know are the people involved.
Well, of course, the other development is very key, isn't it, to the accusations from the mayor of Hoboken about this Rockefeller development.
Right. Yeah, the grant, the development space there. And then, once again, that's development. And my book, The Soprano State, New Jersey's Culture of Corruption, goes into that development thing a lot. It is the mother's milk of politics in New Jersey. Almost everything can be traced back to development, because there's so much money there for lawyers and consultants and all of that. So it conceivably could be that, although, you know, we just don't know. But what we have down in Hoboken is basically a she said situation. There's ways that that can be handled. For instance, the lieutenant governor could have said, well, yeah, I told her that there was some concern about that development, but I didn't tell her she had to do it or she'd lose her money, you know, that kind of thing. And unless they come up with more proof than they've seen already, I'm not sure how they could make that one stick.
Well, Bob Engel, in terms of your book, The Soprano State, New Jersey's Culture of Corruption, where does the, in terms of politics and development, where does the normal quid pro quo in politics, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, where's the line between that and between bribery and coercion, which is what the mayor of Hoboken is bringing up?
It's a very fine line indeed, isn't it? Because no matter which party is in, it's always been understood when that party gets in, there'll be all these goodies that they can control who gets what. Somewhere along the line, I guess it would be if there was some proof that, say, somebody had to make a huge contribution and in return they would get their way out of development or something. I suppose that there's somewhere in there that becomes illegal. But when the book first came out, I mean, particularly, you know, people from California who thought it was the funniest book in the world, but they couldn't understand why people are still walking around when these kind of things go on. And it is in New Jersey law, it can be a very gray area. Things that are illegal in California can be perfectly legal in New Jersey, like holding more than one public office. Back in the day, that, you know, having more than one public pension, that, you know, that was just what they did. Although that would send you to prison in some states. So it's a very fine line, and the lawyers who are dealing with this are going to have to make the determination whether it was crossed or not. I just don't have the legal background to make a decision like that.
Well, but isn't it a bit odd, though, that you've got an administration led by a former U.S. attorney, a former federal prosecutor? I mean, that doesn't sound like a comfortable fit. You know, the politics of the culture of corruption and federal prosecutors.
And I'll tell you this. In the Soprano State, there are very few people who come out looking good. In fact, this stuff is so outrageous, my publisher made me write in there, "We're not making this up," several times, because they were afraid people would think that it was fiction that we were trying to pass off as nonfiction. Every word in there is true. But one of the people who does come off is Chris Christie. He sent more than 130 white-collar political types. They were either convicted or they pleaded guilty or whatever. And that nobody in the history of that office has ever gotten close to that. And that's one of the reasons that people in New Jersey are a little surprised that this happened during his administration. They say, how could a guy who knows what goes on and he knows how to play the game and was elected in large part because he did put so many of these people in jail, how could his administration be involved in something like this? And, of course, his response is, I didn't know anything about this. We're checking into it. That's where we are.
Well, but we all know that at least since the famous Kennedy-Nixon debates that a lot of it's to do with, you know, how telegenic you are as yes. opposed to how clean you are.
Yeah.
And you know, Christie was booed recently before the day before the Super Bowl in New York. So it seems to me that this bully thing is going to haunt him. Would you agree?
Well, I'm asked that a lot, and they usually word it like, okay, so you're in New Jersey, and you people are in-your-face type people, and we can understand why that would be popular there, but how about in the rest of the country, and they thinking that it would turn people off? I'm sure it does turn some people off, but when I was traveling writing the book, and people found out I was from New Jersey, they would say, oh, I love your governor. I like the way he just stands up and says what he thinks. So I'm not so sure that it's as big a turnoff across the country as some people think it might be, since he's never really run for national office and been out in the field in that context. I don't know if we can say that. I do know I've been out in the field with him in New Hampshire and North Carolina, two very different states. And in both places, they just loved him.
Well, but you just in closing, though, you said that this scandal will continue to dog him for
yes.
some time.
Yes.
So as a candidate, he's now trying to raise money. That's the first stage. And the second stage is then selling yourself. He's going to have a hard time, one, raising money, and two, selling yourself as long as the questions are about this damn bridge.
That's exactly right. But there is what the polls are showing is that the people who are now having second thoughts, based on basically the news coverage, is that the Democrats and the independents seem to be the ones who are having second thoughts. Now, that's important to him because he's been selling himself as a guy who can reach across the aisle and deal with the other side. So he really can't afford to lose that segment. Now, the segment that he traditionally has had problems with is the very conservative part of his own party, who are very important in primaries. Now, there is, I think, a scenario in which he can actually do better with this group of people if he can sell this as a news media pile-on and something being orchestrated by those liberal Democrats. That may make him actually more popular with this group that he traditionally has not been popular with.
Well, the ironies of politics. And I thank you so much for joining us, Robert Engel.
My pleasure, sir.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Engel, the Trenton Bureau Chief for Gannett New Jersey Newspapers, who writes a syndicated column called Politics Patrol, an award-winning veteran journalist, broadcaster, and New York Times bestselling author. His books include The Soprano State, New Jersey's Culture of Corruption, and Chris Christie, The Inside Story of His Rise to Power. He tweets at Bob Engel 99. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.